Yo, what's up, everybody? It's Real Sankara Hours. Today is February 4th, 2023. I think this is the first episode of the new year, is it?
No, but it's the
first free. Yeah. Well, anyway, so this is 2023. Yes, it's Real Sankara Hours, your favorite Pan-African socialist political podcast where we talk about politics, current events, et cetera, et cetera.
I know, so we got a lot to talk about today. We tried to record last week, but technical difficulties, so it's probably for the best.
Housekeeping. This is a free episode. If you want to support this podcast, support independent black media, patreon.com/realsankarahours. $5 a month gets you bonus episodes. $3 a month, no access to bonus episodes, but you're just sort of a good friend of the podcast. But yeah, $5 a month gets you access to bonus episodes where we do deeper dives into black radical political theory. Lately, we've been reading Marcus Garvey. So yeah, that's something to expect for a bonus episode. So $5 a month at patreon.com/realsankarahours. And you can also give a one-time payment to Real Sankara Hours just to support the podcast. We have a PayPal link in the show notes. So if you go in the show notes, which has what this episode's about and some links to do further research, we have a PayPal link where you can just send us some money, like a one-time donation, just to keep the podcast going. So anyway, yeah, that's how you can support this podcast and independent black media. So my name's Adam Hudson. I was gonna say, like, follow me at Adam Hudson 5 on Twitter, but I don't even know, like, Twitter's just getting worse. That'll actually relate to.
I deactivated and then I reactivated, but this is Peter M. Gunn as usual. I think let's just get into it. There's obviously, for the namesake of the podcast, and a news item we have to touch on immediately. Burkina Faso finally kicked out the French occupying troops.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Let's start with that.
Some good news.
Some really good news. So there's an article, this will be put in the show notes in Associated Press. Burkina Faso, the headline says, Burkina Faso ends ties with French troops, orders departure. And this article is from January 21st, 2023. So just a couple weeks ago, not too long ago. And the first paragraph says, Burkina Faso's junta government, I mean, that's an interesting choice of words. But this is the AP, so what do you expect? Late Saturday ordered hundreds of French troops to depart the West African country within a month, following in the path of neighboring Mali, whose nation is also headed by a coup leader. And then further down it says, protesters took to the streets of the capital, Ouagadougou, last week to call for the ouster of the French ambassador and the closure of a French military base north of the capital. About 400 French Special Forces soldiers are currently based there, France 24 reported. This is a great thing.
Bye-bye, France. Goodbye.
I mean, obviously, like, the way it's kind of reported here in the AP, it's less optimistic than how we see it, but...
the thing is that, right, since 2012, when there was, when sort of Al-Qaeda started showing up in Mali and West Africa, France did its little intervention and... it's just been sticking around because it misses its old buddies, and what else is France going to do? But it is a victory because Western colonial powers, like, they really want to act like they can't leave, especially the African continent. And so just that, like, it, it, like, in in Western media, obviously, it's like, oh, well, they're being replaced by Russian mercenaries, which, you know, it's all just as bad. First of all, like, this is not to say that, like, you know, I'm a super fan of the Russian military-industrial complex, but I do find it interesting that they're Russian mercenaries, but, like, you know, when it's America, they're private military contractors. Like, it's all the same thing.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, the thing about, like, they, like, yes, it is still part of the narrative that Africa can only be colonized, that it can't ever, you know, make decisions for itself, agency, et cetera, et cetera. But Russia's relationship with Africa is different than the West because it doesn't have that same sort of, like, dependence on extracting wealth. So it very much is like they are doing a service. And also, like, a mercenary or a private military contractor, whatever, they are also easier to kick out. They don't, like, just fucking stick around and, you know, it, that's like a contract. And then when the contract's over, like, you can renew it if the relationship's going well. It's easier for a country to deal with than, you know, this sort. And especially when it is, like, the same people that were behind the ousting of Thomas Sankara. Like, that was straight up French intelligence. And they, you know, in one of the greatest betrayals in history, they... Blaise Compaoré, his childhood best friend, turned against him and chose the French. And he, you know, he was from like 87 until 2013, the dictator of Burkina Faso until, you know, they finally, until, you know, people rose up and got rid of him.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Like, yeah, it, you know, a lot of countries are developing on their democratic path, and it's easier to do so when they're not occupied by their former colonial powers. So, it, you know, we're calling it a W, is what I would say.
Yeah, and also, I think this, I'm reading this article from, I'm going to pull this up from Al Jazeera, written last, published last year, but, no, sorry, in 2021, so technically 2 years ago. But yeah, there was a court that actually indicted, Blaise Compaoré for basically the murder of Thomas Sankara. And last year, Blaise Compaoré apologized to the family of Sankara, but, you know, there's been some mixed reactions. But yeah, like, Compaoré, you know, you know, there's at least a little bit of accountability for him. And I think that was a pretty big deal that, you know, that was done. And also, to follow up from our previous... a previous episode we did last December, right before the new year, with the U.S. Africa summit. I think, you know, like, this move by Burkina Faso, which follows from what Mali did, is that the African continent is showing that, hey, you know what? The West is not a good trading partner, and we're just going to do our own thing. And I think that's, in terms of Africa's relationship with China, Russia, other countries that aren't part of the West, I think that's really what it, I think it has to be viewed from that lens, that Africa's saying, yeah, we're sick of the French telling us what to do and the British telling us what to do and America lecturing us about democracy. And so, yeah, this is something that the West is going to have to get used to. So I think this is definitely some good news. And like I said, I think the Burkina Faso kicking out French troops follows on what's going on throughout the African continent writ large, which is that, hey, you know what, we're just going to do our own thing. And if we want to partner with Russia, basically Africa saying, like, if, you know, if we want to partner with Russia, we'll do it. If we don't want to do it, then we won't do it. If we want to partner with China, we'll do it. And we don't really care what the West says. And I think that's what concerns particularly the U.S. And I think this is one thing to keep in mind. Unlike the Middle East and Latin America, the U.S. hasn't really had a deep, long history of of like extensive imperial military interventions, the way it definitely did in Latin America, and the way it has in the Middle East, from even going further to Afghanistan, Pakistan, whereas much of the imperial entrenchment in Africa has usually been done by Britain and France. And so the U.S. involvement in Africa is largely in cahoots with particularly Britain and France. So so that's one thing to keep in mind when it comes to Western colonization of Western imperialism in Africa. For the most part, the primary players who have been the most responsible for imperial interventions and colonization have largely been Britain and France. The U.S., it's had imperial, obviously, yeah, military interventions in Africa. I mean, the 2011, NATO bombing of Libya is just one recent example. Then there's, the infamous Black Hawk down in Somalia. And then there's, during the War on Terror, there was as Jeremy Scahill reported a couple years ago, that there was the CIA was running basically a black site in Somalia. And, we can go on. So it's not like the U.S. has not intervened militarily in Africa. It definitely has, but not to the extent it has in, say, like the Middle East and Latin America. And most of it's been done by France and Britain, because, and especially with France, part of France's interest in West Africa, particularly that area, has to do with uranium, and a lot of the minerals it has. So, So France has used the war on terror rhetoric to justify its intervention, but it has its own ulterior motives that, like any other Western power in non-Western countries, a lot of it has to do with economic interest and resource extraction.
Yeah, well, France especially, the U.S. is the world-bestriding empire, and we're extracting super profits from all over the world. But France, basically needs Africa to not become a third-world country.
Exactly.
So it's a much more precarious kind of relationship. France-Afrique. Europe, it ain't looking good, but it's a long way to fall. But what the fuck is his name, Macron tried it, but France is gonna be taking some L's. UK is taking some serious L's, and basically the whole thing's held up by NATO. Europe, Western Europe, especially, you had a good run, but yes, thank you. Please, GTFO. moving on to some related news, the tech industry, which actually we will tie back to Africa, in a second, but yeah, you can talk about the layoffs.
So there's this article in Bloomberg that was published December 18th, and the headline reads, "Tech's bust delivers bruising blow to hollowed out San Francisco." Basically, the a lot of the layoffs have had a huge impact on the downtown San Francisco, particularly where all the office buildings are at. For those, if you have or have not been paying attention, there's been, it's kind of been all over the news, so I'm sure, most of our listeners, if not all of our listeners, have heard about this, that basically thousands of people have been laid off throughout the tech industry from different companies. So Meta, which used to be called Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, we can go on and on and on. If you just do a Google of, Google search of
all the fangs, right? The blue chip ones, these are the big guys.
Who are
doing this?
Yeah, and so and So I want to tie this into this article, because before I give like the kind of big picture kind of historical context that led to this, one thing that is interesting to note that I think makes these layoffs particularly unique is that the people being laid off are making six figures. You know, these aren't like traditionally blue collar workers, like in the, you know, like manufacturing or, you know, other types of industries. Like, these are basically,
this is a labor aristocracy, man. They're not proles. They learn
right.
code.
Yeah, exactly. Like, these are people who are part of, I mean, I guess you could say like the professional managerial class, but really, like, these are very, very high paid tech workers who pretty much all of them, I think most of them make six figure salaries. And I was before we recorded, and when I was, you know, working out, I was listening to this this video, which I'll put in the show notes, because I actually think it was pretty interesting. It explained like why a lot of these people make six figure salaries, and a lot of it, most of it, doesn't even come from their base salary. A lot of it comes from stocks. Like, they work for these companies, and they get, like, you know, stock options, basically. And depending on, you know, so their salary increases based on the stock prices of the company. So basically, if the company is doing better, then they get a cut of that through the stock options. So, which is, that's on top of their base salary that they earn for the position that they're working in. So I wanted to bring that up because I think that's what makes these layoffs particularly interesting, because before these layoffs, particularly in the Bay Area, and I think, you know, if people have been reading about how much tech gentrification shaped the Bay Area, probably know about this, but a lot of, you know, the quote unquote techies in the Bay Area, there has long been a class division between the people who work in tech and then people who don't work in tech and who work just, you know, kind of like maybe service sector jobs or typical, like maybe blue collar work or teachers. So what I think is particularly interesting is that, because of these layoffs and because, you know, with inflation, and there was also a lot of hiring done in the tech industry during the pandemic, and particularly in the rise of, you know, remote work and work from home. And now that, I mean, people want to say the pandemic is over. It's not really over. It's just,
we just stopped caring about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so, so now that we're at that point of COVID, you know, like they've kind of, these tech
right.
companies have stopped, you know, that massive hiring they did during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so some of the jobs they cut were, I guess one could say, were, maybe from the company standpoint, like superfluous, like not really necessary. So, but then there's been other people who you think wouldn't be laid off, who got laid off, like people who've been in the company for a while, who were part of, who were, you know, software engineers and arguably part of making the tech and digital products that these companies are known to produce. So yeah, I wanted to make a note of that's what makes these layoffs particularly unique, because the people who are working these jobs, I mean, some of them may be getting some sense of class consciousness, but because they're paid so well and they live a lifestyle that most people who don't work in tech can't afford, unless they work, you know, unless they're, you know, lawyers or doctors or, you know, work in some, you know, some kind of like well-paid
finance.
Yeah, you know, if they, like, most people, they make more money than the average working class
yeah.
person in the U.S. And so that's something I've been kind of thinking about, is to what extent are these rounds of layoffs going to raise some sense of class consciousness among some people in tech, or is it just, you know, probably not going to happen? But
I think that definitely this is a disciplining of the labor force. Like, I mean, you know, I guess I will say to Elon Musk's credit, he's dumb enough to, like, you know, not dress up the language up when he. So you can use Twitter as an example and then kind of sort of draw out the larger, you know, what's going on, which is that, like, you know, people don't like being in offices, and especially when your job is just being on the computer all day, like, there's no reason necessarily. Some people are weirdos and like being in an office, but there are a lot of reasons why companies want their workers in an office versus, you know, everyone working from home. But, you know, they had to do work from home because of the pandemic, you know, once we decided that that wasn't necessary anymore. You know, they wanted everyone back, but, you know, it, not the least because, like, these people pay a whole lot of money for primo real corporate real estate. Like, that is, like, a big part of it. And, you know, the workers are like, no, why would I do that if I don't have to? And, you know, yeah, a lot of these coders are, you know, they aren't. It's not a proletarian job in the sense that they are easily replaceable, or at least they weren't before. That's why they, you know, were able to make that much money. That's why it was that seen as that kind of a job, even if, like, making six figures and living in San Francisco doesn't take you very far. But at least you don't have to commute from Milpitas or whatever. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is capitalism, baby. And, like, you know, they're not going to take this, these corporations aren't going to take this, like, so easily. So no, they're like, yeah, you're getting laid off. But also, like, yeah, these, you know, especially in Silicon Valley or the Bay Area, because San Francisco is not part of the Valley or whatever, to be geographically correct, but Silicon Valley is more of a, at this point, it's just like, you know, that power sector center industry. Yeah,
kind of like Wall Street for finance. Like,
right, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so what was I saying? Yeah, those people, you know, that set of labor force, like, were, you know, basically the first ones that, you know, came with, as the internet and the compute and, you know, the tech sector develops, like, yeah, those workers had a lot of power, but, you know, as everyone, as it grows and as, like, other, as people realize, as other countries, other cities, realize, like, this is like the only new industry, or whatever, like, yeah, there's, you know, every other city has its little tech sector, and then, like, a bunch of developing countries want to have their own tech sector. But this is very, this is a little bit different, or we need to be very clear about what this is, because when you have, like, some sort of, you know, enterprising mayor of, you know, a flagging Midwestern city, right, who's like, we're going to bring tech to this city. Like, you know, usually that means they're getting, like, a corporate campus or something. But what people think it means is they're creating, like, an entrepreneurship class, a new class of capital. But that's not really what's happening, but that's the promise. And, you know, one of the biggest examples of this is in Kenya, where Kenya is touting Kenya's building a tech city. I don't remember exactly what it's called. But, you know, they're getting on board in the 21st century. But what it really is the new digital proletariat. So this is the thing about these, you know, these coders who previously had a whole lot of job security. You know, they're going to be feeling the crunch because... So ChatGPT, I think everyone remembers when that came, you know, hearing about that. I mean, it's making the news about AI. Yeah. But AI is a bit of a, they make it seem like it's machine learning, like it's just this super powerful machine. But, you know, AI is a marketing term, and really what it is it involves a massive amount of labor. In this case, you know, like all these companies, Facebook, like Facebook moderation, they make it seem like it's an algorithm, but it literally is paying people, like, not like, in this case, it's, they pay workers in Kenya like $2 an hour to go through a whole bunch of just, you know, a lot of really dark stuff, like the worst shit you can find on the internet, and they have to classify it. And that's how the quote-unquote artificial intelligence gets smarter, is through human labor. And so when, like, they, you know, when a country or a city is like Facebook, a lot of that, you know, a lot of that was done in Eastern Europe. That was like the, you know, periphery workforce that's more pliable. But, you know, obviously, Ukraine specifically, you know, that may not be a little less feasible. But look, luckily, the role capitalism has carved out for Africa currently is like the last reserve army of labor. So now they're moving to, you know, and Facebook has moderation operations in Kenya as well. And, you know, this is like, just imagine you spend like 8 to 10 hours a day sitting in front of a computer being paid, you know, what might be a good wage in your country, but like is nothing that like Americans would ever do it for. To just look at the worst possible things on the internet and classify them according to the whatever regulations these companies have. And I'll send the article. I was surprised that like Time Magazine did some actual investigative reporting. So, you know, good for them. Like I will, you know, big up media outlets that actually do real journalism, because this is like an important thing to understand about these services. And that's why, you know, I like ChatGPT is like fucking stupid. And, you know, nobody who has any respect for themselves as a writer would use it. But like, of course, you know, the same fucking dipshit college kids who like used to pay people to write their papers, yeah, of course they're going to use it to cheat. And like, yeah, people who have no writing skills, you know, and like that is a depressingly rare skill these days. Yeah, they're going to use it, but like the singularity, like I was a little bit surprised that we're still doing that kind of like AIs are taking over everything discourse. Because we should have the common understanding now that it isn't just like machines versus humans. Like it's like it looks like it's just this powerful machine, but it's backed up by massive amounts of human labor that make the machine run. And so it's, you know, still capitalism, it's just with more screens. So that, I guess, I don't know if that really answers your initial question, Adam, but I think it's a good way to look at these phenomena together.
I say that's a good answer. And actually to bring it back to what I wanted to talk about with just to kind of contextualize how we kind of got, I mean, basically, I think there are some events that happened in the last like 10 to 15 years that led up to this point that I think for just for the kind of historical memory and for the record need to be contextualized. So I'm going to read a couple passages from this Bloomberg article. Again, the headline is "Tech Bust Delivers Bruising Blow to Hollowed Out San Francisco." The subheadline is "Job Cuts and Remote Work Are Colliding to Reshape the Center of American Innovation." So, and yeah, I mean, if you've been to San Francisco recently, there's this big ass Salesforce tower. So Salesforce, this company that does whatever the fuck it does. I know what I mean. They make like
it forces sales.
They make some fucking what the fuck do they make? So they're a software company. Oh, it's okay. Customer relationship management software. Okay, yeah, just bullshit. So it's just like, I mean, cause I'm at the point now where I remember I told you this, Peter, and I was like, you know, if you can't explain your job in less than like 7 words, then your job is probably bullshit. And there's a lot of jobs in tech. I'm like, what the fuck do you actually do? I was like, well, we do customer management, blah 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 blah. I'm like, okay, so you don't know what the fuck it is you actually do. Anyway, so yeah, it talks about Salesforce. They have this big ass tower that was built. It opened up like 5 years ago. It's really huge and it pierces the skyline. It's
tallest building in San Francisco, which really never had that many skyscrapers before.
Actually, well, according to this article, it's the tallest building on the West Coast.
LA doesn't have any skyscrapers either.
Yeah. So the West Coast, is not really known for skyscrapers. So, and just to kind of give some numbers, like in terms of the actual layoffs, Amazon. These are like for January. So Amazon said it would cut 18,000 jobs. Google said it would lay off 12,000 employees. IBM cut 3,900 jobs. Microsoft laid off 10,000 people. And PayPal cut 2,000 employees. And then Salesforce, who I just mentioned, said it would lay off 8,000 employees, or about 10% of its workforce. And then Spotify said it would lay off 6% of its workforce, which is about 9,800 people. So each company's laying off like a couple thousand people, which that's pretty significant. So I'll read a couple paragraphs and then I'll mention, like I said, the events that led up to this, because I think they're worth remembering in terms of the, I think, important shifts in the U.S. economy that lead to where we're at right now. So it says, as mounting signs point to a global recession in 2023, perhaps nowhere in the U.S. stands to struggle more than San Francisco, the center of the technology boom that's now fast unraveling. Nearly 3 years into the COVID era, persistent work-from-home habits, inordinately expensive real estate, homelessness, and crime are colliding to threaten the city's growth and its spot among the world's top-tier metropolises. Thousands of tech layoffs, falling equity values, and the crypto meltdown have only deepened the blow to an area long known for innovation and astonishing wealth. It's here where some of the world's biggest startup successes over the past decade and a half, Twitter, Uber, Airbnb, were born. Just south in Silicon Valley, giants such as Google and Apple flourished and supercharged the region's economy. Then, while San Francisco is far from alone, as cities around the world grapple with shifts in work norms, it's dependent on so-called knowledge workers makes the recovery more difficult. About 72% of the economy is driven by office-based industries. The city's office vacancy rate has soared to more than 25%, hurting local businesses dependent on workers. So it's like, you go to like SF and there'll be these big office buildings and there'll be like some small, like little, like maybe restaurants or coffee shops that serve people who usually, work in those buildings. So the less people who are working, in those offices, it means less customers for those local businesses. Then it says, so it goes on. Last week, Mayor London Breed said that San Francisco faces a $728 million budget gap over the next two fiscal years because of the slow recovery and tech cutbacks, warning that city departments should find ways to lower costs. Another paragraph says, the lack of workers makes San Francisco's broader problems more stark. If people can work from anywhere, they have less incentive to live in a city where they need an income of at least $400,000 to buy a medium-priced house. Homeless encampments are even more jarring amid deserted streets and shuttered shops. Viral smash-and-grab retail thefts have exacerbated negative perceptions about safety. And then there's another one. This one really struck me. Tech accounted for just 5% of San Francisco's private wages in 2006. Just 15 years later, it was over 30%. That's huge. So a jump from 5% to 30% of San Francisco's private wages. Tech accounted for that. So basically, the tech industry.
30% of all people who, like, the biggest employer in most cities is, like, the government, and then, if you think about every single person that works in, like, any given city, like, the idea that 30% of them would come from, you know, one specific industry is, that's, like, a city very much dependent on that industry. Anyway, keep going.
So jobs increased by a third in about 11 years, according to Egan, who called the statistic bonkers. In recent years, the economy expanded more than that of China's. So COVID changed all that, as many of the young workers who fueled the city's surge in wealth decamped to cheaper places such as Lake Tahoe or Austin, Texas. During lockdowns from July 2020 to July 2021, San Francisco lost the most residents by share among major U.S. cities, and even as vaccines brought some return to normalcy, tech companies competing for in-demand workers had little inclination to force reluctant employees back to offices. Focus on that, like, one stat, you know, in 2006, that was before the Great Recession, the 2008-2009 financial crash and the Great Recession. That was before that. So before the Great Recession, 5% of San Francisco's private, you know, wages came from the tech industry. And 15 years later, which that would be like around 2021, it was over 30%. So that's basically, by the beginning of this decade, the tech industry accounted for a third of the private wages in San Francisco, which, that's huge. That's pretty significant. So the question, you know, is, okay, how did it, what led to that change? So like I said, there was a Great Recession that was spurred by the, you know, subprime mortgage crisis and Wall Street, and we get to hold an episode on that. But after the Great Recession, Mayor Ed Lee, who he passed away a couple years ago, but at the time the mayor of San Francisco was Ed Lee, and after the Great Recession, to encourage to basically help boost the economy of San Francisco, Ed Lee gave tax breaks to companies like Twitter to encourage them to set up shop in San Francisco. So there are a lot of tax breaks that the city of San Francisco, under Mayor Ed Lee, gave these tech companies to basically boost the economy in San Francisco. And that was huge. That's really what led to the growth of the tech sector in San Francisco. And also what was happening across the country at large is that the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to historically low levels.
Zero, yeah. Like, right, almost, right. It was free money.
Yeah, and so how does that link to the tech industry? Well, a lot of tech startups took advantage of that because they were literally getting free money to do these startups for, like, oh, you know, we're going to create an app for this and app for that, and da-da-da-da. So after the Great Recession and that financial crash, to help boost the economy, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to historically low levels. And that basically led to a lot of free money that propped up a lot of tech startups in the tech industry. So you have historically low interest rates that occur for pretty much like
until now.
And so now that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to curb inflation, and also, like, you know, they want to start a recession as well. They've kind of made that clear. Now that the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates, now the tech industry is realizing, like, hey, wait a second. Like, this, the balloon is popping. The bubble's popping, yeah, basically, in tech. Because, again, their whole industry in the past 10 to 15 years was propped up by, on the San Francisco level, these tax breaks by the city. And then on a national level, by historically low interest rates. So that led to all these, you know, tech startups and this hiring of people. Now that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, there's less of that free money coming in. And so that's, I wanted to point out to those specific historical events, because I think particularly with these layoffs and what's happening in the tech sector and the ramifications it has for the economy, you know, as a whole, in terms of this looming recession and inflation. I think, like, those two events, like, have to be remembered, because I think they're very crucial to understanding how we got to this point, especially with the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates to historically low levels. Because basically, I think somebody on Liz Franchek, she was on Chapel Chapouts as a guest, and the way she put it was pretty funny. She said, now everybody's realizing that their personnel is relied on low interest rates, which is true. Like,
yeah,
like, so much of the tech sector, it got this huge boost from, again, essentially free money from the Fed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it relates to just the completely detached from reality kind of idea. The California ideology, you know, is the name for it. The techno-utopianism that was just like, yeah, we are the new gods, the new overlords. We're taking over the world. And it got to the point that, like, you know, the whole thing is that these companies aren't profitable. Like,
right,
they're getting these insane valuations and stuff. Like, in old school industrial capitalism, like, you know, however horrible it was, like, you had to demonstrate that your company was profitable. Mm-hmm. Profit was is almost a dirty word, or at least was, you know, in the sort of whatever the heyday of that time period was, because it's like, if you have to take you start an app and then the whole point is just to get a whole bunch of people on it, using it, and you haven't figured out how you're going to make money from it. And then, you know, eventually you monetize, but, like, that may not mean that you have a sustainable business that, like, reliably generates profit. And it's not that all of them are like that, you know. Like, when I talk to people, you know, friends, like, people we went to school with who, like, have jobs in that sector, like, plenty of them, like, you know, it is, like, a normal industry or whatever, but, like, there is just, like, this insane level of, yeah, it is a bubble machine on top of it, like, and it is to the point where you almost couldn't even call it capitalism, because it's, like, it's all just people making up money, you know, like, it's like the next step beyond financialization or something. And, you know, crypto enters in with that. Like, you know, we're on the internet 3.0 or something or whatever. Like, the internet is an ideology, you know, in the sense that, like, it's like they're trying to, like, after a point, people, like, you know, you can only spend so much time on the internet. You can only spend so much money on the internet. You know, people like it was, you know, it was the attention economy. Well, you know, eventually people are going to run out of attention. They're going to, you know, touch grass, et cetera, et cetera. And so, like, that is, you know, rate of profit tends to fall. And so, you know, that's, like, why, I mean, you know, that's why Facebook's doing the metaverse or whatever. Like, they need to get, you know, they still need to get, you know, people who are excited about the internet and still think it's going to take over the world and not just see it as what it really should just be seen as, which is an infrastructure, a global communications infrastructure.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's like the internet trademark, you know, if you think about it, like the internet versus just like the literal internet. And, yeah, like though, you know, it was destined to, you know, hit a wall, hit a reality check, you know, to some degree. So that, yeah, like that it's happening now, is, you know, that's the boom and bust cycles of capitalism, baby, you know?
And that's something that, you know, Karl Marx wrote about. I mean, I think
Karl Marx did not consider Silicon Valley. You know, that's why he's wrong. You should never listen to anything he said about anything else.
Right. Yeah. And actually, something you said about tech earlier, I mean, reminds me of you know, like what I was saying about Salesforce, but like, what, you know, what the fuck do they actually do? Yeah, comparing the tech industry of today to earlier industrial capitalists, you know, like U.S. Steel, you could point to what they're producing, which is steel.
You made commodities.
Yeah, you made something that you can point to is crucial to industrialization, like steel for, you know, making skyscrapers and buildings, like the beams that hold them up, or railroad companies that, you know, that
you right. Yeah, you understand the service they charge. Now we have content.
Yeah, or like I said, with Salesforce, they're a cloud based, fucking cloud, a cloud based. I'm reading the sort of Wikipedia definition. How they describe them. It provides customer relationship management software. It's focused on sales, customer service, marketing, automation, analytics. So a lot of this is like just algorithmic, cloud-based. Like it's not something that you can, like a physical object you can point to that. We need to produce this to produce this. It's not like they're making chips. Which is, that's, you know, where, you know, silicon, the chips, hence the name Silicon Valley, you know,
that's what it started doing.
Yeah, exactly. So that's like a physical, tangible product you can point to that, okay, you need these chips and these circuits and these processors and these microcomputers that make up computer technology. And then, you know, it creates the internet. You know, that's something, again, you could physically point to that, oh, we make this product, the silicon used in transistors and computer chips. With this phase of tech, it's not even about producing computer chips or any of that stuff. It's just all, it's the cloud and everything's algorithmically driven. And I think that's what I wanted to point out, is when we're looking at tech, it's hard to physically point to like what it is that they actually produce, versus, again, the previous era of, you know, tech a couple decades ago, where you can point to actual computer hardware that the tech industry
or software, like you made like it was physically released on a CD,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I guess there's some other stuff we should probably. I mean, I don't really want to talk about it, but, you know, it's happening, so.
Yeah, so Tyree Nichols, I mean, you know, there's the number and names of, it's just how, you know, sick this country is, that black death at the hands of police is just so common that, you know, we list down the names of people who've been killed by the police, or, you know, even at this point, saying killing is probably a little too generous. You might as well just say murder. So yeah, like earlier in January, you know, Tyree Nichols, he was a 29-year-old black man. This is January 7, 2023. This happened in Memphis. He was, police pulled him over in a traffic stop, and initially it was reported that there were five black police officers who basically just beat the shit out of Tyree Nichols, and he died three days later. And the officers claimed they stopped him for reckless driving. So they pulled him from his car, used pepper spray, tasered him. And then, you know, he managed to kind of like break away and run away. And then when they caught up with him, they beat him for like 3 minutes, punching and kicking him in the head and hitting with a baton. And 3 days later, he was pronounced dead. So yeah, he was born June 5th, 1993. He died January 10th, 2023. He was 29 years old. I mean, he was just only 6 months away from turning 30. So he didn't even get to reach the age of 30. He was raised in Sacramento. He moved to Memphis in 2020. He had Crohn's disease, so he was very slim. So he was like 6'3", weighed 145 pounds. But he really loved skateboarding and photography. And I want to mention those details just to, you know, show that he just seemed like just
a chill dude,
someone you want to hang out with, and just a generally just decent human being whose life was snuffed out by these fucking assholes. But like I said, it was initially reported that there were five black police, that the culprits were five black police officers. Turns out there was a sixth officer who's been fired, and that officer's white. So, and I want to mention this because even like, you know, some of the discourse on Twitter was just bullshit. But, you know, some people on the left were like, well, you know, it's not always about race. How can you say it's white supremacy if there's five black police officers? Well, it turns out like it's
neo-colonialism, like, dipshit.
Right. Yeah. And also, it seems like that the black police officers were the ones who were initially to hung out to dry for the white police officer. So, but I thought it was pretty just ridiculous that people would jump on that to make, you know, those sorts of, so, that sort of point. But, you know, there is video release of it. And this is what I wanted to comment on, was that the way the video was released and how it was announced was very sick, because it was like, you know, tonight at 7, watch these police officers beat the shit out of another black man. And it's like, the way they announced it was like Beyonce dropping another album, or, you know, the latest album from Future. It was like that. And I spent years writing about, reporting on police killings of black people. You know, Alton Sterling, obviously we talked about George Floyd on this podcast, like right when it happened. But before, you know, George Floyd, there was, you know, Oscar Grant, Walter Scott, Michael Brown, Tatiana Jefferson, Sandra Bland, Breonna Taylor. I mean, we can go on and on and on and on and on and on down the list of the names and numbers of innocent black people whose lives were unjustly snuffed out at the hands of American law enforcement. Then obviously Trayvon Martin, who was killed by just some vigilante acting under the color of law. You know, and there is one point, like maybe 10 years ago, when cell phone cameras were somewhat kind of new and somewhat revolutionary, in that, we could finally record these incidents of police brutality. And that, you know, basically because black America, black people in America have long known that the cops, you know, are racist and will beat the crap out of us. And but it was always like we were always in the position where large numbers of white people, white America, just, you know, just didn't believe what black people were saying. So it was like, okay, maybe if the more people, particularly the more white people who see these videos and see actual video evidence of black people being killed or brutalized by the police, that somehow, like, that the hearts and minds of America in general would change. And that,
you know, not that, really sure why, but yes.
Yeah.
We were told that, like, because, I mean, Oscar Grant was, like, the first one on, like, a cell phone camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, like, police have been killing the entire time. You know, there is a ritual, like, it is ritualized this form of Black Death. I mean, lynchings were public events. They were reported on, and you know that, like, now it's content. Now it's we need, for some reason, you know, this is a necessary part of America in this specific way. And, you know, the fact that it is, you know, that, like, I think the important thing to understand is that, like, the system is, you know, it's a white supremacist system, in that, like, it needs Black people to keep Black people in their place, the Black working class in its place. Let's be very clear. The fact that it is, the fact that, like, white people also, you know, poor white people also sometimes are collateral damage, the fact that, you know, petty bourgeois Black people are collateral damage, and the fact that, like, sometimes Black people themselves are more effective as administrators, enforcers of this system, it doesn't challenge, it doesn't, that the system doesn't have a problem with that. It does, they don't, that doesn't matter. Like, I don't, you know, it took so much just to get the average person to stop thinking about it as skin color, which, like, you know, like, that, you know, that we can finally understand these things a little bit more structurally. And, like, but even then, you know, people refuse to believe it. They, Americans need their heads up their asses, because they can't admit what's right in front of them. And, you know, but like, you know, human impulses intervene after a point, and it's like, it is insane to, that we accept that the, you know, if this were one of the evil authoritarian countries that were just like, yeah, our state security forces kill people in broad daylight, you know, thousands of them every year, you know, like, this, it would be, we, you know, what would we say about a country like that if they were, you know, Russia or China or whatever? Like, this is, you know, in the land of freedom or whatever. You know, that it's a contradiction that a lot of people, they really can't resolve it within themselves. But because you can't understand that, like, this is, the point is, you know, that this is, like, it is super structural, but it also is, like, an industry in and of itself. Like, in, you know, and this is, like, because, you know, it goes back and forth. Like, is racism super structural? Is it part of class or whatever? But we are at the point where, like, you know, and this is, like, you know, thinking about Cop City, it tied the two together. And it's, like, America, you know, yes, we've built the disciplinary and suppression structures for, you know, workforce that we don't have anymore, because we don't have industry like that. So now we just have, like, our industry is repression, and it is enforcement, and it is, you know, and in order to justify that, you need stuff like this. So you need events that, that cause people to fucking freak out and threaten to overturn, you know, and burn shit down, which, you know, is, like, a total, like, in the sense of, like, what the social contract is supposed to be, like, events like this should call for that. But, I, you know, like, this is, like, we need, like, for the 16 fucking intelligence agencies, for all of the different Fed programs, for, you know, on top of the cops, on top of, you know, state police, on, you know, and private security, you know, like, we are, like, for the garrison state and the related industries to work, we need, like, so, yes, like, the question coming out of Black Lives Matter wasn't, like, are the police going to stop killing? Of course they're going to kill, but the question is, how can the system absorb this in a way that keeps, you know, the progressives sort of in orbit and, you know, remains profitable for the related industries, you know? So this is them figuring it out with, like, timing the release of video to, like, oh, are you guys going to do it? you know? That's my take on it, at least.
Yeah. My take is pretty similar, and you know, we're getting close to an hour, so I'll say my piece, and then we can wrap up. So I mean, first of all, I refuse to watch the video because, you know, it's like I said, I spent almost 10 years of my life writing about this stuff, even talking to family members, mothers who lost their children to the hands of police, and you know, like that definitely had an effect on me. And so and there have been studies and articles written about this that just routinely seeing videos of Black death at the hands of law enforcement has caused like PTSD like symptoms in a lot of Black people. So I think just for the mental health of Black people, it's a good idea to not watch those videos all the time. That doesn't mean you shouldn't watch them at all, but I think watching them all the time and being overexposed to them does have a serious negative impact on one's mental health, particularly on the mental health of Black people, because, you know, we're coming from centuries-long intergenerational trauma that stemmed from, again, the transatlantic slave trade, and then from the abolition of slavery to 100 years of Jim Crow racial apartheid. Then after the end of that, then you have the rise of mass incarceration and the war on drugs, and this current iteration of the American police state and prison state. So this spectacle of Black death is happening within that context. So I think it is good for Black people to be more cautious about when and how often they watch how often we watch these videos. And to get to my earlier point about, again, like when like smart cell phone cameras were new, there was some hope, I think, within like some sectors of progressive media that, okay, you know, the more, you know, if we have video evidence of this, then we can make a case that there is a problem within American police and that changes have to happen to prevent these deaths from happening. But, you know, in 2020, there was these large-scale protests against the police murder of George Floyd. The whole world saw that video. And one would think that would be enough to make some substantial changes to police in America. But
no, because we went too far and we burned shit down. So that therefore we need more cops, because people are going to burn shit down over the police. It's a beautiful, it's an endless cycle of more money for the police. It's profit, baby. Like,
deeper than the profit part. Yeah. I think what it does, it desensitizes people to Black yes. death. That's what
also
I
that.
That's what I want to get at, is that what one would think, like, again, from the 2020 protests against the police murder of George Floyd, where, again, the whole world saw that video. It wasn't just like white America that saw it. There were protests all across the world, in Europe, Asia, Latin America, and even Black people across the diaspora were looking at that video and saying, hey, wait a second, we're experiencing the same shit here in France or the UK or Latin America. I mean, Latin America, even though it's a lot of those countries are not like majority white like the US, there's still anti-Black violence there, because, yeah, again, Latin America has a very similar history when it comes to, one, the transatlantic slave trade and the legacy of European colonization. In the case of Latin America, it was the hands of the Spanish and Portuguese, and here in North America is more the British and Anglo-Americans. But, you know, so everyone saw this, and again, one would think, and there was all this talk about, like, maybe we'll have a reckoning when it comes to race. And I remember at the time, I'll go back to what I was saying at the time, that I was pretty skeptical about the change that would happen as a result of those protests. And I hate to say I told you so, but, I told you so, I was right. Because I was, you know, skeptical about like how much change this would lead to, just knowing just about like America itself and just you know, white America in particular, because I remember there was a one article we brought up one of the episodes around that time where support for Black Lives Matter actually declined after a couple months, and now it's kind of remained stagnant. But when I mean support for BLM, that's support for BLM from people who are not Black, like non-Black demographics, whites, Latinos, Asians, like among them it all declined. With Latinos and Asians, I think with Asians, I think it's somewhere around like 68% support Black Lives Matter. With Latinos, I think it's somewhere like 60%. And then with white people, I have the numbers right here. Yeah. Wait, this is 2020 or some shit. Oh, here we go. They remain unchanged, yada, yada, yada. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. For white people, the support for Black Lives Matter is 47%,
nice.
which means that less than half of white Americans support Black Lives Matter. Latinos, it's 60%. Among Asians, it's 68%. And I think the stat among Asians is pretty interesting because, you know, there's been kind of like this with the rise of the Asian hate crimes, like a lot of the blame has been pit on Black people for some, like Black people became the scapegoat for like anti-Asian hate crimes, even though like most of the people perpetrated them were not Black, they were white, but Black people became the sort of scapegoats. And so like even in the media there's been kind of like this weird pitting of Blacks against Asians. But despite that, among all non-Black demographics, Asians in America are the most supportive of Black Lives Matter, which I think is interesting. I think it's you know, it's a little bit of
throwback to now.
And so again, like despite the protest and all this kind of outpouring of goodwill and calls for solidarity, you know, nothing has changed. And in fact, if you look at the number of police killings, they've gone up. They've increased.
Yeah, man, they're getting it in.
You know, I'll just mention this point, and then yeah, we can kind of close out or wrap it up. But what I think these videos, rather than them being catalysts for progressive or revolutionary change, what has done is it's had the effect of desensitizing people to Black death, that now we've just accepted as normal that, oh, there's a video of a Black person being killed by police. And again, it is like lynching. It's kind of become like this really sick ritual where everybody gathers around and watches, you know, some Black person getting the shit
yeah,
beat
it
out
is,
of them.
Yeah,
you know, and everyone just watches it. And then it's the same old thing. Like they watch it and they say, "Oh my God, this is so awful. How could this happen?" You know, support for the family. It's the same old song and fucking dance. It's the same old goddamn routine where like Black person gets killed by police, we show the video, there's all this outpouring of sympathy and, you know, fake tears and yada yada yada, like what people are doing with Tyre Nichols. But when I guarantee you within the next couple months people are going to forget about it, they're going to move on to the next fucking thing, and then until the next video is released of a Black person being killed by police, and we'll be back to the same old fucking song and dance. And nothing substantive changes on a policy level. So that's what, again, like I find it so fucking sickening that these videos have just desensitized people to Black death rather than serve as catalysts for change. And so, but fortunately, like, you know, there are those of us who are still keeping that fight up. We count ourselves among them and many others, but you know, even among like the kind of some of the activists who kind of became famous in the midst of Black Lives Matter, both the first phase and second phase, you know, they've kind of used the BLM movement to make a little cash grab for themselves, get speaking gigs and get famous.
Yeah.
But, you know,
well, that's the thing that did change. We got a police reform nonprofit industrial complex, which is part and parcel of the policing industry. Like,
yeah.
I don't like to I'm not trying to be that kind of a guy, but it's true. If you just look at it hard enough, like prison reform is the nonprofit, you know, arm of the prison industry, you know, policing, police reform, like, because everyone was very clear, like, what, like, Moon was very clear about his demands. And, like, if you're with the movement, then this is what you support. And, you know, all the good white liberals were like, you know, we're not really feeling it. These election polls, we're all too scared. We don't want to, you can't fight the police. And so instead of taking away money, let's invent more bureaucracy and just like more new old tricks and tips to give the police more resources. And we're going to expand, you know. We're going to give more money to the police, rewarding them to, you know, giving them incentives to kill more often. And yeah, you know, to like, yeah, they're convinced that they can ride the tiger. And just like, yeah, you know, they want to desensitize it. So that, but like, they can fuck up. Like if, you know, if someone get, you know, it's, yeah, it like, and then just like, everyone fucking loses their shit as they rightfully should. But, you know, I mean, this stuff can get so depressing, and I'm very much trying to not be depressed at this part of my life. So, let's try to end on an uplifting note, because I got a few minutes before I get kicked out of the library here. You know, like, with all this, they use all this violence and repression, and, you know, they always have, because it's nothing more than fear. Like, instead of being like, big bad America, we're going to go do genocide. It's like, no, you guys are fucking scared little babies, honestly. Like, the fact that you have to behave this way is because you guys are fucking scared. You're fucking scared of us. You're scared of black people because they know how fucking awesome we are. Like, they actually, deep down inside, they know it. They hate us because they ain't us. And like, that's why they have to do all this. That's why, you know, and also like to prop up their stupid little industries or whatever. But like, at the end of the day, they understand the power that we have, and they are afraid of it. And if you just look at it like that, like, you know, they can't do it forever. They can't do it forever. Like, Africa is coming back. We stay unified with the continent, and we stay focused. Like, it's not going to be easy, but, like, that is, like, our history. And it's not going to end with, you know, fucking content of ritualized killings. Like, it's still going, like, and, you know, like, the beat remains. Like, it is almost kind of like, trying to think about like history in that sense, getting away from like the European framework of dialectics. And it's like, yeah, there's the beat goes on. Like, yeah. So it's not going to last forever. Like, you know, this is a scared empire. This is a scared empire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're behaving this way.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to end it. And one thing one small little point I'll add is that I think what America's I think there's also a fear that black people, particularly black Americans, we have an ability to inspire other groups of people to do change. You know, like I think that's one thing that the system is also kind of afraid of, is that I think they rely on some sense of buy-in from other groups of people and being able to use them as a wedge against black Americans, that, hey, you know, you're hardworking, you're hardworking, you're a good minority, unless unlike those, you know, effing N-words over there, you're not like them. So if you're just a good minority, there's not going to be racism against you. Well, ask other communities in this group, in this country, or even just look at the history, and you'll see that that's absolutely wrong. And so much of change in America, particularly when it comes to race and challenging white supremacy, a lot of it has been inspired by the struggle of black people, new Africans in the U.S. So that's one positive thing I'll say to kind of just end this episode is the ability of black people in the U.S. and around the world to inspire other groups to fight against their oppressors. And I think that's a good thing because, as my late grandmother used to say, the white man did his homework, you know. So it behooves us to do our homework to overthrow his system. But anyway, so let's, we can wrap this up. That's the end of this episode. Thanks so much for listening to us. Again, this is a free episode. If you want to listen to bonus episodes, patreon.com/realsankarahours. $5 a month gets you access to bonus episodes. And also in the show notes, there is a link to our PayPal if you want to make any kind of one-time financial contribution to Real Sankara Hours to keep this podcast afloat. So anyway, do you have anything else to say, Peter? Otherwise,
Bill Gates, I just find it hilarious that Bill Gates' daughter, who goes to Stanford, is dating a black guy and she's posting it on Instagram and everyone's mad. And I find it hilarious because Bill Gates has spent so much money and effort doing quote unquote population management in Africa. And then look what happens. So, you know, but also, man, like, man, we fucked up. We could have had heiresses, but instead we're devoted to the struggle.
Yeah.
There we go.
All right. Anyway, signing out. Keep the faith.
Stay dangerous.
Peace out.
Peace out.